So welcome to the final lecture in the series for Journalism and Communication Studies. Thank you. And as you can see, the topic of conversation, no matter how fascinating it might be to chat amongst yourself, is the Hearth and Home, the rise of the magazine market. And what I'm going to spend the next 35, 40 minutes doing is just putting a little bit more additional detail on some of the things that Jane Chapman introduced a couple of weeks ago, just to really open up some of the sort of areas you might like to consider if you're doing this as an essay question, or indeed in general. I think it's really important from the perspective of yourselves as prospective journalists to look at the way the market is changing and adjusting and indeed mutating in terms of the current scenarios and so on. I'll then talk a little bit more about some specialist essay aspects that we've just literally published on Blackboard, and then effectively you'll be free to go, hopefully. So why focus in terms of magazine journalism to start off with? Always a good question to consider, because actually if you look at journalism histories and journalism studies per se, it's a fairly neglected area. There are people who kind of investigated it to a certain extent, but if you look at the kind of Bible of journalistic histories, Curran and Seaton's Power Without Responsibility, there's actually very little to say on this whole topic of magazine journalism. And yet, if you take one cursory glance at the adverts in The Guardian, the independent news packages and so on, or any of the online advertisements, consistently journalistic jobs are being offered by the magazine industry. In fact, the magazine market has been a significant employer of journalists throughout the 20th century and indeed into the 21st century. And today I'm going to concentrate primarily upon the changing nature of the magazine market in the first 50 years of the 20th century. We'll explore why the demand for magazines grew so substantially, how the titles and the contents of those magazines also changed to reflect the changing nature of the marketplace in which they were operating. And we'll also focus particularly on the burgeoning market for children's magazines and women's magazines, both of which were phenomenal success stories of the last century and arguably still so today. I also want to mention briefly that 20-year period in the latter part of the 20th century, early 21st century, which saw the phenomenal growth of the men's lifestyle magazine market. FHM, who actually recorded sales in February 2000 of just over 700,000 copies per month, is now no more. But equally, IPC's Woman, Woman's Own, Woman's Weekly, they have a weekly sale in excess of 500,000. So clearly something is going right when it comes to IPC. But let's actually sort of move on to the whole notions of the first sort of stage, which is creating a magazine market. Actually sort of finding out how this developed. Now, many writers have actually argued that it was actually the extension of literacy across the United Kingdom through the Education Acts of 1870, 1880, and 1891 that effectively meant that there was a ready-made market for people who wanted to have something to read. In other words, there was a prompt to develop something which actually had light reading, not in-depth analyses of particular political thoughts and theories and financial matters and so on, but basically reading for fun, reading for entertainment. In fact, contemporary critics in Victorian times often blamed Forster's 1870 Education Act for the rise of what they referred to as bad reading tastes. That Education Act actually ensured that technically elementary education was made universal for every child in the country. You would have the basic tenets of reading and writing. Joseph Ackland, who wrote a work entitled Elementary Education and the Decay of Literature in 1894, also noted that the intellectual faculties of the nation were too long in bondage. Quote, "He shall not cause any wonder that when the shackles of ignorance were struck off, there was a rush to the fields of fancy and pleasure." So this whole notion of intellectual bondage, that actually reading, writing, arithmetic, it's got to be unamusing, it's got to be serious material all the time, that's kind of thrown away. And if we actually go on to consider George Gissing writing a novel called New Grub Street, Gissing actually takes it a stage further. New Grub Street is a novel about the publishing world. Yes.
Do you repeat the dates for the ages?
It's being recorded. Okay. Play that. Okay. But actually, for that whole thing, 1894 was basically when Ackland actually came up with his criticism and the blame for the 1870 Education Act. Okay. So George Gissing, New Grub Street, what's it about? It's still available, you can still access it online and probably download it almost free these days. And what he actually suggested here is that the publishing industry in the 1890s was creating titles that was catering for a vast readership whom he described as a quarter educated. Significant point, a quarter educated. Gissing's novel refers to a fictional magazine which he called Chit Chat. And according to Gissing, Chit Chat is aimed at the young men and women who can just read, but that's about it. They've got the attention span of goldfish in contemporary terms. They might be able to work out the basic reading, but anything else, any deep thought, deep thinking, forget it. It's trivial. And clearly that notion of being incapable of sustained attention is at the heart of Gissing's criticisms. It's like you're only listening to commercial radio, you never listen to Radio 4. In terms of being a thinly disguised criticism of a very popular magazine of the time, that of Titbits, that again was very much, I think, a Gissing sort of heart routine. So what was Titbits, which was first published in 1871? Ahead of Pearson's magazine, there we have it, Titbits. Titbits was primarily a snippet paper. It literally was easy to read. It contained a lot of trivia. It contained of what we might regard as useless information. And the editor of Titbits actually described his intentions perfectly clearly in the first issue. With that quote. Again, it's up there. It's well worth considering. It's the editorial decision, the mission statement, if you like, the core values of the magazine Titbits. The business of the conductors of Titbits will be like that of the dentist, an organized system of extracting. And then the guarantee. Then the guarantee that effectively says, actually, it's not just trivia here. Anybody who actually purchases the magazine for 3 months will, at the end of that time, be an entertaining companion. So if you were Johnny No Mates or Josephine Wallflower, you would clearly have this notion of, hang on, this is a way of improving myself. Without necessarily having to really work at education and work through that, I could shell out my shilling or half shilling or sixpence or couple of tuppence, etc., for my edition of Titbits, and that'll be it. Social success. At the end of that time, I'll be an entertaining companion, and you have, interestingly enough, in terms of the generalisation, we're looking very much at the masculine here, and I think that's not to be discounted here, he will then have at his command a stock of smart sayings and a fund of anecdotes which will make him society agreeable. So it's using a shortcut. It's using, in a sense, the kind of equivalent of saying, look, you don't need to actually read quality newspapers like The Economist or The Spectator. Stick to TMZ and BuzzFeed. That's all you need. Okay, maybe. There are two sides to every story. Titbits was actually praised on one level as a unique path towards edifying the masses. It actually did provide some kind of source of entertainment for mass consumption. But it was equally criticised as symbolising the decline of British journalism. And if we look at some of the latter incarnations, pretty much you see where it developed and where it metamorphosed into before becoming kind of associated, as its name might suggest, with the soft porn market of the late 90s, early 2000s. So again, you're looking at the celebrity, the lines of that, the scandal, the lines of the whole thing there, how girls made the Fonz a nervous wreck, why girls can't resist me, etc., etc. Is it quality journalism? I think you'd be pushing the boat out to say, yes, it was, but is it actually raising the sort of continual notion of what's happening in a culture? Maybe it is. Tickbits by 1888 was selling an average of 350,000 copies a week. And inevitably, rival publishers noted the success of Tickbits and sought to produce alternative titles. There's nothing that actually succeeds like other people jumping on your bandwagon when you've actually created something which is new and different. Pearson and Harmsworth, who later became Northcliffe Press, produced Pearson's Weekly, which I showed you at the start of the slide again. Similar type of magazine, short snippets of information. Nothing new. We have top 10 lists now. We have a whole range of short, snappy scenarios that come into most magazines and publications. Answers to Correspondence was also a similar newspaper, a similar magazine to Tickbits. Again, aimed at the commuter, aimed at the lower middle class mail market, aimed also again at people who effectively wanted to have something quick and easy to read and consume. Competition between rival magazines was fairly immense. It was also quite ingenious. Prize competitions were used effectively. Something we haven't talked about, certainly with my two seminar groups, that often publishers would offer prizes of money and incentives to actually buy their magazine, you're in with a chance of winning a prize, and so on. Perhaps one of the most curious prizes was actually offered by Answers to Correspondence, in which Harmsworth, the publisher, offered an insurance scheme to his readers. It went as follows. If the reader was injured in a railway accident while carrying a copy of the magazine, the victim would be paid £1,000. Actually, nobody ever claimed it, as far as we can recall, because clearly you had to have a perfect storm there, be at a railway, be injured in a rail accident, and make sure you had your copy of Answers to Correspondence in your hand before you could actually say, I claim my £1,000. But it's still an interesting way of, again, developing things. During the flu epidemics, Pearson's Weekly would actually claim that its actual pages were sprayed with eucalyptus oil as a preventative. Whatever we may think of those particular early examples of free gifts, they were clearly spectacular in terms of their successes. And by 1909, Harmsworth was publishing 50 titles whose combined circulation was 8.5 million copies on a weekly basis. Harmsworth's firm, the Amalgamated Press, founded boys' papers such as Wonder and Marvel, which introduced Sexton Blake Detective. Marvel, no relation to the American company of the latter years and present time. And also Harmsworth went on to establish a magazine market for women with titles such as Forget Me Not in 1891 and Women's Weekly in 1911, which 90 odd years later is still actually going strong. Harmsworth's strategy in terms of magazines was to target magazines to a specific audience. Unlike newspapers, they were looking for mass markets. It was a mass medium that they wanted to actually exploit. Not saying newspapers weren't mass market areas, but these were specifically looking for more magazines, more readers, more topics, and so on. But society is changing. Society is adjusting and moving into a whole different areas that we're working through. And although the figures look impressive, and they work through that, nevertheless, the years between 1900 and 1920 and 1930 had huge changes that were taking place in society. Changing occupational trends meant that many proprietors, magazine proprietors and newspaper proprietors, would specifically look to develop titles that would appeal to women in jobs such as working in mills, shop assistants, domestic servants. There was that audience identification in terms of who people were actually looking for, what they were waiting for, what they were identifying with, and so on. One of the initiatives that was developed at this stage, which again was put forward by Harmsworth, was very much the notion of how do you actually get people to buy more copies of press? And his solution, start off serials, S-E-R-I-A-L-S. Serials that were stories that started in one newspaper, and if you or one magazine, and if you wanted to actually find out how that story continued, you had to buy a completely different magazine. Now, on one hand, that increases sales, but on the other hand, it did increase complaints to newsagents by irate customers. Suddenly, they need to buy more than one magazine to actually get the whole story. not a unique thing. Cliffhanger endings have been used. The end bits of Marvel movies are the same thing. These are techniques that are manifest in the present day. But again, the end product, how do you actually buy more products? And certainly by those early years of the 20th century, as you can see, there was substantial growth in terms of magazine. This literate population was developing. And yet actually, if we roll back a little bit, even before 1870, there was a considerable population of literate, working-class individuals who worked within Britain. But mass magazine sales only became a key part of British journalism at the turn of the 20th century. So again, why? Well, according to Roberts, in his account of growing up in Victorian Salford, the magazine's vast increases in circulation weren't due to their literary content, but they were based on the introduction of spectacular competitions, which offered readers dazzling cash prizes, pensions for life. And undoubtedly, the whole growth of the magazine market had a lot to do with marketing and with advertising. In order to be able to sell that, mass readership with disposable income was required. And that was what was coming about. The Industrial Revolution had taken place. People had more leisure time. They had more things to do. They could be engaged in organized sport. Families were reducing in size. And you actually had more disposable income. This growth of organized sport, popular betting, modest domesticity, and the communication of working class entertainment is very much that perfect storm of all the ingredients being in place to ensure that, as far as the consumers are concerned, they're getting the magazines that they actually want and need. And so are our children, which we'll come to in a few moments. If you only have two children or three children, as opposed to 9, 10 or 11, you've got more disposable income. Arguably, the notion of having 9 or 11 was to actually have a number of spares, because obviously child mortality was at high rates during the Victorian era. But assuming that's the case, and you've only got two or three or four children, then clearly you've also got publishing possibilities being opened up in the market of children's magazines. Now, prior to the First World War, the majority of children's magazines were actually targeted at boys. Titles such as The Boy's Own Paper, Young England, Chums, and The Captain, all very middle class in orientation, all aimed at boys between 10 and 15 years of age. They would celebrate the public school ethos. They would run articles about the history of Eton and Harrow and public schools that were known for their quality of educational product. They would talk about the public school spirit, and they would pursue what we refer to now as the cult of athleticism, the notion that actually on one level, being the amateur, the gifted amateur, was far more preferable to being a filthy professional who would actually take money for playing sport. That celebration of amateur sport, again, a recurring feature. Magazines such as Chums would also contain detailed information about sporting techniques, regarding cricket, regarding athletics. Actually, up until the second half of the 20th century, there was relatively little material that was available on topics relating to the budding sports people and technique. So if you wanted to find out how to fish effectively, or how to improve your batting or your golfing skills and so on, you kind of had to either resort to specialist magazines again or work through the process within that. We don't see the growth of the sports personality and the development of the cult of the sporting hero until really the 1920s and 1930s, in which footballers, cricketers and so on start becoming mass popular figures, partly because of the input of radio and the newsreels and so on. Chums itself would set its stories for young boys on the frontiers of the empire. And remember, at this stage, Britain pretty much was looking after a third of the world. There was a British Empire. So the stories that would be manifest within the comic areas would very much relate to virtues of British pluck, standing, upstanding scenarios and so on, and the whole notion of what people would do with their pith helmets and other souls within the empire, the great empire side of things. Middle class manliness was defined on the pages of magazines very much in terms of tenacity, in terms of daring, and in terms of moral decisiveness. The language that we see being used by the writers here relates to playing the game, knowing and obeying the conventions of good form, usefulness, loyalty. Certainly in their attitudes to the lower classes, comics such as Chums and The Captain were quite explicit. They regretted, as I said, professionalism in sport, and they celebrated the tall, clean-limbed, athletic amateur above the bullet-headed, bull-necked professional. As the historian Robert MacDonald actually concludes in his examination of early 20th century Boys magazine, the simple truth of Chums, in which life was an adventure, war a game, and an uncomplicated love of country stood above all, became the code of men. A code whose strength, simplicity, and intense romanticism was echoed in the dramatic summons to defend England. All, in a sense, seen as partial manipulation, partly sowing the seeds for what became the slaughter on the fields of Flanders, partly this notion that war itself was on some level simply a game that the readership would entail or would engage in. And that final concluding sentence, playing the game, was the true mark of chivalry, glory, honour and sacrifice, the supreme values of an ancient race. UKIP would have loved him, or loved the sort of line. Writers employed on such magazines clearly felt that they were charged with a most responsible task. They were training the future generations of citizens, and they were also addressing some of the central issues of the day. Those issues included the nature of morality, the possibility of decadence, and the duty of patriotism. Now, the First World War, as I mentioned, a game changer in more ways than one. Because quite clearly, as writers such as Rudyard Kipling found when he lost his son in World War I, what we were actually seeing was way separate and totally different from this apparent nobility that had been effectively sold to the children of the country and the war folk, etc., as the way forward. It was a disaster in a lot of ways. But what it also led to was this whole notion of saying, okay, let's change things around. Let's adjust this whole issue relating to children's magazines. Let's open up the market. Let's expand that market. And obviously, where there are pennies to be made, that market did expand. And we see the growth of magazines not only for boys, but also girls as well. Girls' titles began to appear such as School Friend, Schoolgirl's Own, Schoolgirls Weekly, and Crystal. And all of those were owned by a company called DC Thompson. Not the Eagle, that's another story which we'll come into in a few moments. DC Thompson effectively published the Beano. They also published Adventure, The Rover, The Wizard, The Skipper, and The Hotspur. Again, according to Ross McKibben, a majority of boys of all ages and in all kinds of schools read comics. Wizard itself was read by half of all grammar school boys and two-thirds of senior school boys. A quarter of the time girls spent reading magazines was devoted to the boys' comics, despite the fact that they seemed to make no concession to girl readers. And many children would read more than one magazine. In fact, in a 1930s London survey, over 50% of children would read three or more magazines a week, and 30% would read six or seven magazines a week. Not that they'd buy them all, but they'd swap them in playgrounds, and they'd effectively have multiple reading arrangements. The circulation of children's magazines had a slight decline in the 1930s, partly because of the growth of radio. Again, as a mass medium, it was viewed as a way of attracting listeners to the radio with the Ovaltines and so on. But actually, what a lot of the magazines started doing was running stories and adventures which featured characters that they could hear on the radio. So again, you had a wonderful case of both mass media working in harmony to develop, you know, sales and so on. During the war, comic magazines, despite the loss of paper and the reduction of paper and routines, they still actually tended to increase, and actually the overall sales during World War II were fairly significant. And as I've already mentioned, again, share the thought, you also had the use of propaganda, but a different kind of propaganda. The propaganda purveyed by the superheroes of Superman, Batman, the Justice Society of America, and so on, who very much were on the side of democracy against the Axis powers and so on. And there are lots of examples from Captain America and other characters beating the proverbial out of the Axis powers, be they Japanese, be they Italian, be they German, and so on. After the 1950s, though, the post-war period, there was a sense that within Britain we needed to combat this American invasion of culture and, in the words of Frederick Wertham, the author of Seduction of the Innocent, develop this whole notion of providing an alternative answer. Hence this magazine, The Eagle, which your grandparents might have heard of, possibly your parents. Dan Dare was one of the main characters that came out of Eagle, Pilot of the Future, set up by a clergyman at the time, and very much focusing on the notion of kind of providing more colourful, dynamic images for the readership to develop and take into. Certainly there were a whole range of things which incorporated school stories, joke pages, competition stories, and so on. You would have under the DC Thompson banner characters such as detective adventurer Dixon Hawke in Adventurer of the Wolf of Kabul, and so on. All of those editors of the children's comic market would use their editorials to effectively adopt what's now regarded probably as a confiding intimacy with their readers. You can look back at editorials in The Wizard, for instance, and see a page which is called Step Right Up and Have a Chat with Your Editor. My dear chums, see the reading, see the heading. That's the spirit. No hanky-panky, get right down to bedrock and have a chat. You and I like two pals. That's a clumsy attempt at building some kind of intimacy between the readership and the editor. But is it any different from 2000 AD and the mighty Tharg ending his editorials with Borag Thorn? Boys' magazines became the subject of a celebrated attack by George Orwell in the 1940s. Orwell, of course, the author of 1984 and Animal Farm, wrote that their political assumptions are two. Firstly, nothing ever changes. Secondly, foreigners are fun. Orwell maintains that even under DC Thompson and in the 1940s, the comic book magazines had a mental world which was stuck, at least in Britain, at 1914. There was no slump, there was no unemployment, there were no trade unions, there were no strikes, and there was certainly no fascism. The magazines were full of racial stereotypes. The working class were absent, except as comic figures or villains, and the magazines were full of racial stereotypes relating to most whites being good, except, of course, the Germans, and all non-whites and Chinese were the subject of intense ridicule. You had a character called Chaz Feng, who was fond of saying the white race will learn one day the power of the yellow peril. Jew, the black giant of Nigeria, for some reason went berserk and terrorised both Bedford and Leighton Buzzard. Now, it is difficult when you look back online, or indeed in actuality, at some of the stories and narratives that were coming through these magazines. But it's also difficult to measure the impact of those particular stories and narratives on young minds. In theory, given that these had been popular consumptions for children way before the 1945 end of the Second World War and from the 1930s onwards, then arguably there's no reason to expect those folk to actually vote for a Labour government. And yet, actually, they did. We had a Labour landslide in 45 for the first time ever, which was very much a serious departure from what was perceived as being the way that children's magazines were brainwashing folk at the time. Even though DC Thompson did have a very explicit editorial process. They, as I mentioned, produced The Wizard, Hotspur, Beano, and so on. If you wanted to work at DC Thompson, you had to undergo several tests. These weren't shorthand, these weren't sort of practical tests, these were psychometric tests to find out primarily if you were the right sort of person to work within the team. And given that actually editors for DC Thompson would often work for the company for 50 years or more, you were screening the employees so to ensure that employees were compatible with the firm and also compatible with its moral purposes. So each applicant for a job at DC Thompson had to sit a test paper, and the aim of that, as noted by the editors, was to try and find out which way your imagination or your brain or your thoughts tended. primarily on that and general knowledge about the world about you, where you either got a position or you didn't. So asking for feedback in terms of how you could improve was pointless. You either fitted in or you didn't fit in. The relationship between the writer and the editor at DC Thompson was also very close. Now, that was primarily to ensure that the stories, whether it was Biffo the Bear or Corky the Cat or the Bash Street Kids or a People's Friend story, were basically written to the firm's exact specifications. All of the writers were freelance, none would be kept on the staff, and writers would be visited by senior editors who effectively would provide them with a roster of story ideas for their work. Consider the output as far as journalists are concerned. One freelance writer actually claimed to have written 8 million words of fiction during his 8 years of working for Thompson's. That's 1 million words per year. Makes the 2,000 words seem mild by comparison. And many of the writers for DC Thompson would actually switch from writing for the company's children's magazines to producing copy for its women's magazines, including titles such as The People's Friend. Which brings us, strangely enough, to that whole notion of women's magazines and magazines for women. In the late 1890s and the early part of the 20th century, a range of specialist women's magazines started to appear. These were catering for the sporting interests of ladies of leisure. So very much the upper middle class market were the targets of the women's magazine system. Titles such as The Lady Cyclist in 1895, The Wheel Woman in 1897, The Hockey Field in 1910, Ladies Golf in 1912, and The Golfing Gentlewoman in 1914. Both cycling magazines would carry advice, news, information, and interviews, and cycling at this stage is very much seen as part of the onset of modernity. Having a bicycle means you can actually have a lot more freedom of movement. You can leave your village, you can go to town, you can cycle around the whole areas. We don't have mass automobile challenges from that point of view. It's very much seen as a fashionable area, arguably still is, coming full circle. All well and good. But then we had, as I mentioned, the First World War, the Great War. And certainly in the interwar period between 1918 and 1938, you had a huge expansion of the women's magazine market. Over 60 new women's magazines were launched between 1920 and 1945, many of which had a domestic bias, with titles such as My Little Home, Mother, Woman and Home, and of course, the pièce de résistance, you can see it there, Good Housekeeping magazine. At the top end of women's magazines, you would have magazines such as The Lady, still with us, see it in most major supermarkets. The Queen, also there. Those were magazines which would cater for the aristocracy and the gentry. People effectively were arguably part of the establishment, either through hereditary or through acquisition or wealth, but they were very much at the top of society's tree. But this new range of magazines, of which Good Housekeeping and the Ladies' Home Journal were very much part of that whole driving aspect, was something which was new in its own way, but not so different as what Chums and what Titbits were looking at earlier in the century. In this particular instance, the magazines were being read by the socially ambitious. Vogue magazine, Harper's Bazaar, the Condé Nast titles, the Cosmopolitan of the time, the people who effectively like to read stuff to kind of not only keep abreast of the times, but also feel that they were fashionable, that they wouldn't be seen as out of touch. And the emphasis of many of new titles such as Good Housekeeping, Women and Home, My Home, and Modern Home was quite simply on informing middle-class women how they could actually cope in a changing society. A society in which servants were becoming scarce, that there wasn't the opportunity for servants to effectively look after cleaning up, sweeping, cooking, all of those areas. These might fall under the responsibility of the lady of the house to sort them out herself. Technology, particularly domestic technology, was also becoming particularly important. Catherine Hallward is a writer who took a close look at Good Housekeeping. Good Housekeeping initially was an American magazine. It launched its own British version in March 1922. What was the theme about Good Housekeeping that really opened up this particular aspect? Well, women's magazines have always been seen as playing a crucial role in the advancement of what we can refer to as the cult of domesticity. Many women's magazines have tried to elevate the image of women as homemakers by attempting to dignify what elsewhere could be seen as drudgery. The notion that keeping your household clean and tidy was something to aspire to, not to fret about other manly issues such as earning coins and pennies to eat, not to actually go out and educate yourself. Consider keeping the house clean. From the 1920s onwards, as the standards of living of middle-class families continued to rise, and servants became more difficult to hire, or owing to more attractive methods of employment, there was a market for magazines which developed rapidly. Now, on the one hand, many women readers would be thirsty for information about domestic technological advances. What would be the best vacuum cleaner to buy? What would be the best cooker to buy? What would be the best dishwasher to buy? And so on. And we see this certainly post-1950 with the whole growth of consumerism, where actually this whole notion of a bright future in which actually regularly purchasing white goods is at the heart of the consumer drive is very much at the heart of the magazine industry as well. And what Good Housekeeping actually managed to do was to synthesise two key things. That desire for information by middle-class housewives, and also the manufacturers of the goods themselves needed to find some way of getting their advertisements to their potential customers. And so Good Housekeeping became quickly aware of that, and so they introduced the Good Housekeeping Seal of Approval. There we are. Any product that was seen and commented on by Good Housekeeping magazine would actually have this Good Housekeeping bright red star of approval. This notion that effectively it would be a guaranteed refund if any particular goods that was advertised or goods that were advertised in the magazine were found to be unsatisfactory, again, you could claim a refund. Certainly much more successful than having to hold a copy of the magazine whilst you're having a railway crash at the same time actually claiming your £1,000 because you've been injured. But still using that whole line of saying, how does this actually get people that level of trust with your writers of the magazine to purchase stuff and so on. Again, in the early 1920s, the assumption of advertisers in Good Housekeeping was primarily that they were aiming at women who enjoyed domestic help in the home. Labour-saving devices such as the vacuum cleaner were very much being sold as an aid to the domestic servant initially, rather than the lady of the house herself. It's interesting to see that in 1923 there was an advert that stated that a Hoover was no longer a luxury, it was a necessity. It, quote, frees you and your servants forever from the tyranny of the broom. And as the 1920s progressed, there was a gradual shift which occurred as adverts increasingly portray the housewife using the vacuum cleaner or polishing the furniture in ads, always looking as though she was thoroughly enjoying the experience. Now, other magazines in the women's market also were aimed at the lower middle class audience. Titles such as Woman's Own, launched in 1932, Woman in 1937, always targeting this notion of the lower middle class, but the person who's basically getting on with life to a certain extent. Now, those magazines weren't filled with adverts for new domestic technology. It would have been pointless. The potential readers couldn't have afforded the material in the first place. Higher purchase was not an option, and they were too expensive for working class people to afford. But they did have a stated aim of enhancing the domestic capabilities of their readership. And I'll quote from the editorial from Woman's Own in 1932, which launched itself as follows. How do you do? We introduce ourselves and our new weekly for the modern young wife who loves her home. Woman's Own will be a paper with a purpose, a paper thoroughly alive to the altered conditions of the present day. The home paper that makes any girl worth her salt want to be the best housewife ever, and then some. You don't have to be an expert in ideology to appreciate the kind of message that's working through on that basis. But if you were still confused, you also had a free gift of some wool, which came with the first issue. test it. Win-win. It also contained the first episode of a romantic serial. And features included the right sort of frocks to wear, the right kind of aspects to do, as well as various other ongoing serial narratives. So you've got the notion of escapism, you've got the notion of fantasy, you've got the notion of where people are actually going, all of which are working on this awareness of, again, in terms of the images that we actually see. The whole notion of magazines doing their things, etc., just as you can look at an online service, paying no attention to what's being said, and say, oh, this is quite amusing, let's switch off completely. In terms of the whole sort of premise that we have here, the next stage, of course, is the cult of celebrity. And that's actually for another time, because clearly what you're also developing here is what became the popular ethos that led to Hello Magazine, OK Magazine, and a plethora of movie fan magazines that also celebrated the fascination that we actually have with celebrities. And that cult of celebrities is something which, as I say, I need to mention, be aware of, but it's not something I want to necessarily spend too much time on today. So, concluding the sort of piece from this sort of perspective and returning briefly to some of the key things here before I talk a bit more about your essay packages today. If you're looking at the Hearth and Home, the magazine sort of area, the key things are basically points 2, 3, and 5, okay? The second point, why do you get this creation of a magazine market in the first place? Answer, increasing and improved literacy. It's pointless having magazines that people can't read, unless it's totally photo-based and you're looking at pictures alone. Secondly, the ideology of children's magazines, what's being said, how they've been promoted, how actually children's comics, in a sense, they're looking to provide the next generation of readers who hopefully will continue to buy magazines as they work through their own experiences. And fifthly, on that broader basis, how women's magazines have also changed and adjusted as well. Now, concluding this, I want to actually move on to this next one here. If you go to the Blackboard site for Introduction to Journalism Studies, you will be able to download this set of slides, 12 of them, which effectively talk about the joys and wonders of essay writing. And what we've actually done for that, as well as just some reminders of what you're actually doing, is talk about 7 key steps that you should be putting into practice if you're sort of a little bit concerned about this. Again, we'll spend a bit more time in the room, certainly Sarnham Cinema, I think, this week, and anybody else that wants to talk with myself or Imke about this, we'll work through this as well. In fact, has Imke's group, have you seen this already?
Yeah.
Yes, good. Okay, so just very briefly, if you haven't sort of worked through that, have a look through those sort of areas. It tells you a kind of step-by-step series of examples, because I know a couple of people, Ian, asked me about those. The final thing I ask you to do is make sure you've signed the register, and I bid you well, and I'll see you anon. Cheers.